good, even if baby's the only one seeing you all day. So hit the shower and maybe even the blow dryer before your spouse hits the commuter train in the morning. Trade in the stained sweats for a clean pair and consider applying a little makeup and a lot of concealer. Wear your baby. Baby wearing can boost your mood and babies. Babies who are worn more cry less, and that's a happy fact. Leave home. It's amazing what a change of scenery can do for your state of mind, especially when the scenery doesn't include the cluttered mess that was once your home. So try to get out of the house with baby at least once a day. Take a walk, stroll the mall, grab a coffee with friends. Anything that will keep you from hosting another, understandable, self-pity party. Treat yourself. Next time you have 30 minutes to yourself, grab it. Take a nap, a long shower, a mini mani, or a chance to catch up on social media or a guilty pleasure celebrity gossip site. Occasionally, make yourself a priority. You deserve it. Get moving. Exercise boosts those feel-good endorphins, giving you an all-natural and surprisingly lasting high. So join a postpartum exercise class. Look for one that includes babies in the fun. Work out to a postpartum exercise DVD or a YouTube video. Step out for some exercises that tone with the help of a stroller full of baby. Or just simply step out for a walk. Be a happy snacker. Too often, new moms are too busy filling their baby's tummies to worry about filling their own. A mistake, since low blood sugar sends not only energy levels plummeting, but moods too. To keep yourself on a more even keel, physically and emotionally, stash sustaining, healthy, easy-to-munch snacks within quick reach. Tempted to reach for a chocolate bar instead? Go ahead and reach, especially if chocolate really makes you happy. Just remember, sugar-induced blood sugar highs have a way of crashing quickly. Opt for dark chocolate when you can, since it's much lower in sugar and is believed to have mood-boosting properties. Cry and laugh. If you need a good cry, go for it. But when you're finished, watch something silly on TV or online and laugh. Try laughing, too, at all the mishaps you're likely having. You know, the diaper blowout, the breasts that leaked in line at the market, the spit up that spewed only after you realized you'd left home without wipes. You know what they say. Laughter is the best medicine. Plus, a good sense of humor is a parent's best friend. Still blue no matter what you do? Keep on reminding yourself that you'll outgrow the baby blues within a week or two. Most moms do. And you'll be enjoying the best of times, most of the time, in no time. But also remember that there's a big and very significant difference between baby blues and postpartum depression. If the baby blues just don't fade or appear later than expected, if feelings of sadness persist, lasting more than 2 weeks, or get worse, and or if you start to feel very anxious, you may be suffering from postpartum depression or another postpartum mood disorder.
I don't have any sign of baby blues, but my partner seems really down. Could he have baby blues?
Does your partner seem to be down while you're flying high? Studies show that a new dad is far more likely to experience baby blues when the new mom in his life escapes them. And conversely, he's unlikely to be down when she is. Perhaps nature's way of ensuring that both parents don't slump at the same time. Hormonal changes, dads experience those too postpartum, may be a trigger when dad gets the blues, as may all the inevitable life changes that come with a new baby. Either way, it's important that he not keep his feelings under wraps, something a new dad may feel compelled to do to avoid dumping on his partner. Encourage him to talk them out.
For dads, your baby blues. Becoming a dad was the happiest moment of your life, and holding your bundle of joy fills you with more joy than you even knew was possible. So why are you so emotionally spent? After all that buildup, all the planning and preparation and dreaming and drama and anticipation and exhilaration, your child has been born, and you feel not only run down, that's the sleep deprivation talking, but also a tiny bit let down. Welcome to the postpartum club, when you suddenly realize why the word baby is so often followed by the word blues. Not every new parent experiences the so-called baby blues. About 10% of new dads do, But you can pretty predictably expect a potent cocktail of emotions in both of you. Fortunately, it's likely only one of you will experience down feelings at a time. Be ready and be strong. You'll need the patience of a saint, the endurance of a triathlete, and a sense of humor, big time, to work through this period of adjustment. Adapt the tips for her baby blues to your needs during this rough patch. If those don't help, and baby blues progress to depression, talk to your doctor about getting the help you need so you can start enjoying life with your new baby.
Wearing away the baby blues. There's no doubt it's the ultimate in hands-free baby care, allowing you to soothe your baby, rock your baby, even eventually feed your baby without lifting a finger, leaving your hands and arms available for just about anything else you have to get done. But can baby wearing your little one in a sling or carrier, also wear away the baby blues in new moms and dads, or even help ease postpartum depression? Some say yes, and for several reasons. Wearing your baby close to you, like skin-to-skin contact, increases your levels of oxytocin, one of the body's happiest hormones, also known as the bonding hormone. Oxytocin not only helps cement your emotional connection to your baby, but relieves stress and eases postpartum aches, both of which can bring a new mama down. In fact, low levels of oxytocin have been linked to postpartum depression, as well as postpartum anxiety disorders. Pumping up the oxytocin by wearing your baby may actually boost your mood. Wearing your baby makes your baby happier. Babies who are worn more cry less and sleep and feed better. And what could make a new parent happier and more confident than that? Wearing your baby leaves your arms and legs free, free to eat a meal, catch up on work, get the laundry done, and yes, even do your hair, all of which can make you feel better. Wearing your baby lets you get out more. There's no easier way to take a walk, do the marketing, have lunch with a friend. Plus, a baby who's worn isn't easily touched by prying, possibly germy strangers, an added perk. Of course, if baby wearing isn't for you, you just don't feel comfortable doing it, don't feel obligated. Remember, every mom is different, and what feels right for you is almost always what's best for you. Keep in mind, too, that while baby wearing may be very therapeutic for new moms battling the baby blues or even mild depression or anxiety, it may not be the answer for every mom, and it's likely not enough to treat more serious postpartum depression.
Postpartum depression. I felt so happy after we brought our baby home, but in the last couple of weeks, I started feeling really down, sad, hopeless even. Should I write it off as baby blues?
Though baby blues and postpartum depression are often used interchangeably to describe new mom moodiness, they're actually two very different conditions. The far more common baby blues appear and fade quickly. True postpartum depression, PPD, is much less prevalent, affecting about 15% of new moms, and much more enduring, lasting anywhere from a few weeks to a year, or even more. It may have roots in pregnancy depression, it may begin at delivery, or more often, it may not start until a month or two after baby's born. Sometimes PPD comes far later. It doesn't begin until a new mom gets her first postpartum period, or until she weans her nursing baby, possibly because of fluctuating hormones. More susceptible to PPD are women who've had it before, have a history of depression or severe PMS, spent a lot of time feeling down or depressed during pregnancy, had a complicated pregnancy or delivery, or have a premature or sick baby. Women who've had a miscarriage or stillbirth are more susceptible to postpartum depression and anxiety with a subsequent healthy delivery, often because they can't shake the feeling that something will go wrong again. The symptoms of PPD are similar to those of baby blues, though much more pronounced. They include crying and irritability, sleep problems, not being able to sleep or wanting to sleep the day away, eating problems, having no appetite or wanting to do nothing but eat, persistent feelings of sadness, emptiness, hopelessness, and helplessness, an inability or lack of desire to take care of yourself or your newborn, social withdrawal, excessive worry, aversion to your newborn, feeling all alone, and memory loss. If you haven't already tried the tips for getting the baby blues to fade, do try them now. Some of them may be helpful in easing PPD too. But if moderate symptoms continue for more than 2 weeks without any noticeable improvement, or if you're having more serious symptoms for more than a few days, chances are your PPD won't go away without professional attention. Don't wait to see if it does, and don't delay at all if you're having symptoms that might result in harm to yourself or your baby. And don't be put off by reassurances that such feelings are normal postpartum. They're not. Call your practitioner and be upfront about how you're feeling. Ask for a referral to a therapist who has a clinical background in the treatment of PPD and make an appointment promptly. Therapy, the first line of defense, can help you feel better fast. And if your therapist thinks medications will help too, there are several antidepressants that are safe even if you're breastfeeding, though it can take time to figure out the right meds at the right dose. Bright light therapy can also be effective in reducing symptoms of PPD by causing a positive biochemical change in your brain that can cheer you up. Other CAMP therapies, healthy eating, and exercise can also help minimize symptoms, as can baby wearing. Since postpartum thyroiditis can trigger depression, your practitioner may also want to check your thyroid levels. The same tips that are used to deal with pregnancy depression apply to PPD as well. Whichever treatment or combination of treatments you and your therapist decide is right for you, and even if it takes time to figure out the best treatment in your case, the most important first step is the one you're taking: acknowledging that you're depressed and seeking help. Without the right treatment, PPD can prevent you from bonding with, caring for, and enjoying your baby. It can also have a devastating effect on your baby's emotional, social, and physical development, on the other relationships in your life, and on your own health and well-being.
For dads, keep an eye on her mood. Baby blues are one thing. They're normal and self-limiting, but true postpartum depression, PPD, is another. It's a serious medical condition that requires prompt, professional treatment. The same goes for other postpartum mood disorders, including postpartum anxiety disorder, postpartum OCD, postpartum PTSD, and postpartum psychosis. If the mom in your life still seems truly overwhelmed, sad, angry, anxious, or hopeless several weeks after the baby comes home, isn't sleeping or is sleeping all the time, won't leave the house or let anyone come over to visit, isn't eating or isn't otherwise functioning normally as can be expected given her demanding new mom life, sit down with her and tell her you're worried about her well-being. Focus on the behaviors you've seen: crying constantly, raging for no apparent reason, refusing to leave the house or answer the phone, being uncharacteristically anxious, jittery, or stressed, not interacting well with the baby, and encourage her to share her feelings with you. Reassure her that whatever she's going through is in no way her fault. It's not because she's weak or a bad mother. And remind her that you are and will be there to support her every step of the way. Emotional support from a partner is an essential component in the recovery from PPD. But don't stop there. Encourage her to talk to her practitioner about it, and as needed, to get a referral to a psychotherapist or psychologist. Don't leave it up to her if she says no. Make the calls yourself. She may not recognize the signs of depression. Be sure you know the signs, and understand that she may not experience all of the symptoms. Postpartum depression and anxiety are not one-size-fits-all illnesses. Make sure she gets the treatment she needs to feel better, and be as supportive as you can of the treatment plan that's proposed. If one treatment method doesn't work, and it won't necessarily, at least at first, encourage her to be open to others, and not to give up. PPD is treatable, but finding the right treatment sometimes takes time. And though much of your focus will understandably be on your partner as you try to help her get better, realize that for now, she may not be up to much, or in a severe case of PPD, any of the baby care. Step in to provide the nurturing your newborn needs, and if you can't provide it all because of your work schedule, try to find a friend or family member, or baby nurse if you can afford one, to fill in as needed. Keep in mind that it's normal for you to feel frustrated or disappointed that your partner isn't over the moon happy in her new role with your new baby. So don't fault yourself for feeling that way. Find ways to give yourself a break too. And remember, there are other dads who know exactly what you're going through. Check out the support pages for dad on postpartum.net. Be aware too that dads can also suffer from PPD. Your own hormones are in flux postpartum too, and it's natural for the combination of the new baby, the stress of the past 9 months, and the new sense of responsibility to take their toll. In fact, 1 in 4 dads experience paternal postnatal depression, PPND, a dad's version of PPD. You may feel left out, or you may feel overwhelmed by everything that's expected of you. If you suspect you have PPND, talk to your partner or a trusted friend or family member about it, and don't hesitate to seek professional treatment for the health and well-being of both you and your baby.
Getting help for PPD. No new mother should have to suffer from PPD. Sadly, too many do, either because they believe it's normal and inevitable after delivery, it isn't, or because they're ashamed to ask for help, they shouldn't be. PPD can keep a new mom from nurturing her little one, which could lead to slower development. Babies of depressed moms are less vocal, less active, make fewer facial expressions, and are more anxious, passive, and withdrawn. Luckily, there is more and more awareness about PPD and the need for new moms who are suffering from it to get the help and treatment they need. Most hospitals send new moms home with educational materials about PPD, so that they, and just as important, their partners and other family members, will be more likely to spot the symptoms early and seek treatment. Practitioners are becoming better informed, too, learning how to look for risk factors during pregnancy that might predispose a woman to PPD, to screen routinely for the illness postpartum, and to treat it quickly, safely, and successfully. Pediatricians, who have many more opportunities to interact with new moms than OBs or midwives do, are often the first line of defense when it comes to spotting PPD. The AAP recommends that pediatricians screen for PPD at 1, 2, and 4 month visits by asking new moms to complete a short checklist called the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale, basically 10 questions designed to reveal whether a new mother is struggling with PPD. PPD is one of the most treatable forms of depression, so if it strikes you, don't suffer with it any longer than you have to. Speak up and get the help you need now. For more help, contact Postpartum Support International at 800-944-4PPD-4773 or postpartum.net. Thyroiditis got you down? Nearly all new mothers feel run down and tired. Most have trouble losing weight. Many feel blue at least some of the time, and just about all experience hair loss. It may not be a pretty picture, but for the majority of moms, it's a completely normal one in postpartum, and one that gradually begins to look better as the weeks pass. For the estimated 7 to 8% of women who suffer from postpartum thyroiditis, PPT, however, this picture may not improve with time. And because the symptoms of PPT are so similar to those weathered by most new moms, the condition may go undiagnosed and untreated. PPT may start anywhere from 1 to 4 months after delivery with a brief episode of hyperthyroidism, too much thyroid hormone. This period of excess thyroid hormone circulating in the bloodstream may last 2 to 8 weeks. During this hyperthyroid period, a new mom may be tired, irritable, and nervous, feel very overheated, and experience increased sweating and insomnia, all of which are common in the immediate postpartum period anyway, making an easy diagnosis more elusive. That's okay, because treatment isn't usually needed for this phase. In about 25% of women with PPT, this hyperthyroid period will be followed by one of hypothyroidism, too little thyroid hormone, that often lasts about 2 to 6 months. With hypothyroidism, fatigue continues, along with depression, longer lasting and often more severe than typical baby blues. Muscle aches, excessive hair loss, dry skin, cold intolerance, poor memory, and an inability to lose weight. Again, so close to typical new mom symptoms that they may be easy to write off as postpartum as usual. Some new moms with PPT experience only hyperthyroidism, while others have only hypothyroidism, which begins 2 to 6 months after delivery. If your postpartum symptoms seem to be more pronounced and persistent than you would have expected, and especially if they're interfering with your ability to function and enjoy your baby, check with your practitioner. A blood test can easily determine whether PPT is the cause of your symptoms. Be sure to mention any personal history of thyroid problems or a family history, especially on your mom's side of the family, since there is a very strong genetic link. Most women recover from PPT within a year after delivery. In the meantime, treatment with supplementary thyroid hormone can help them feel much better, much faster. About 25% of women who have the condition, however, remain hypothyroid, requiring lifetime treatment, which is as easy as taking a pill every day and having a yearly blood test. Even in those who recover spontaneously, thyroiditis is likely to recur during or after subsequent pregnancies. For this reason, it makes sense for women who have had PPT to have a yearly thyroid screening and, if they are planning another pregnancy, to be screened in the preconception period and during pregnancy, because an untreated thyroid condition can interfere with conception and cause problems during pregnancy. Beyond postpartum depression. New moms often have ups and downs, occasional moments of feeling overwhelmed and stressed, even anxious, and most do more than their share of unnecessary worrying. For the most part, that's the adjustment talking and the sleep deprivation, and it's to be expected. But sometimes it's not as easy as that or as normal. Postpartum mood disorders are distinctly different from typical new mom mood swings, and they come in many forms, sometimes accompanying PPD or appearing instead of it. All the following postpartum mood disorders need prompt diagnosis and treatment. If you notice any symptoms of these conditions, don't delay in getting the help you need. Postpartum anxiety disorder. Some new moms, instead of or in addition to feeling depressed postpartum, feel extremely anxious or fearful, sometimes experiencing panic attacks that include rapid heartbeat and breathing, hot or cold flashes, chest pain, nausea, insomnia, dizziness, and shaking. Women with a history of anxiety or panic attacks during pregnancy or before are more likely to experience these symptoms postpartum. Postpartum anxiety affects about 10% of new moms, and about half of those who have PPD will also experience postpartum anxiety. A mom with postpartum anxiety may feel a constant sense of dread, as if something is about to go terribly wrong, or she'll worry constantly about her baby's health and development, her ability to parent well, and how she's going to balance parenting and the rest of her responsibilities at work and home. These worries aren't the normal new mom worries, they're more extreme, and are typically not based on any real problem or threat. For instance, a mom suffering from postpartum anxiety may be fearful that her baby is alarmingly sick or in pain every time he or she cries, or that she might fall asleep while holding her baby and drop him or her, or have a pervasive, nagging fear that her baby has died, or that she's left her baby in the hot car, or that someone is going to break into the house and kidnap her sleeping baby. Sometimes a new mom suffering from postpartum anxiety may feel restless and jittery all the time, even though she's exhausted. Postpartum anxiety, like PPD, requires prompt treatment by a qualified therapist. Such treatment may include therapy, talk, or cognitive behavioral therapy, learning techniques such as meditation, relaxation exercises, and mindfulness training, and, if necessary, medication. Postpartum obsessive compulsive disorder, PPOCD. About 30% of women suffering from PPD also exhibit signs of postpartum obsessive compulsive disorder, PPOCD. Though PPOCD can also occur by itself, symptoms of PPOCD include obsessive compulsive behaviors, such as waking up every 15 minutes to make sure the baby is still breathing, developing an obsessive order for doing ordinary tasks, like tapping on the light switch 3 times before turning it on, and worrying that straying from the order will cause her baby harm, furious house cleaning, or having obsessive thoughts about harming her newborn, such as throwing the baby out the window or dropping him or her down the stairs. Women suffering from PPOCD are horrified by their gruesome and violent thoughts, though they won't act on them. Only those suffering from postpartum psychosis might. Still, they can be so afraid of losing control and following through with these impulses, they may end up neglecting their babies. Like PPD, treatment for PPOCD includes a combination of therapy and antidepressants. If you're having obsessive thoughts and/or behaviors, be sure to get help by telling your practitioner about your symptoms. Postpartum psychosis. Much more rare and much more serious than PPD is postpartum psychosis. Its symptoms include loss of reality, hallucinations, and/or delusions. If you're experiencing suicidal, violent, or aggressive feelings, are hearing voices, or seeing things, or have other signs of psychosis, call your doctor and go to the emergency room immediately. Don't underplay what you're feeling, and don't be put off by reassurances that such feelings are normal postpartum. They're not. To be sure you don't act out on any dangerous feelings if you're alone while you're waiting for help, try to get a neighbor, relative, or friend to stay with you or put your baby in a safe place, such as the crib. You can also call 911 or the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. If you're a dad noticing symptoms of postpartum psychosis in your spouse, get her help immediately. And in the meantime, don't leave her alone with a baby for even a moment. Postpartum Traumatic Stress Disorder, PTSD. The safe delivery of a healthy baby should be a moment to remember with joy. But for the estimated 9% of new moms who suffer from PPTSD, childbirth becomes a source of pain and anxiety. Triggered by a traumatic event during labor, delivery, or postpartum, such as an umbilical cord prolapse, shoulder dystocia, a severe tear, hemorrhage, or an emergency C-section, or by a perceived trauma, feelings of being powerless, or not having adequate support during childbirth, PPTSD can leave a new mom with flashbacks and nightmares that vividly replay and possibly magnify the traumatic birth. Or she may feel detached from her baby and others, have difficulty sleeping, anxiety and panic attacks, an exaggerated startle response, and disturbing, intrusive thoughts. Women with a history of depression, anxiety, or prior trauma, a sexual assault, for instance, or a terrible car accident, are at higher risk of developing PPTSD. PPTSD is temporary and treatable, usually with therapy, so if you're experiencing any of the symptoms of the condition, don't wait to seek professional help. Without treatment, new moms suffering from PPTSD are less likely to get routine postpartum care, less likely to breastfeed, and more likely to have challenges bonding with and caring for their newborns.
Losing weight postpartum. I knew I wouldn't be ready for my skinny jeans right after delivery, but I still look 6 months pregnant 2 weeks later.
Loved your pregnancy bump, but not such a fan now that you're no longer pregnant. Though childbirth produces more rapid weight loss than any fad diet, an average of 12 pounds overnight, most new moms don't find it rapid enough, particularly once they catch a glimpse of their still pregnant-looking postpartum profiles in the mirror. The fact is, no one comes out of the birthing room looking all that much slimmer than when they went in. Part of the reason for that protruding postpartum belly is your still enlarged uterus, which will be reduced to pre-pregnancy size and relocated to its previous pelvic position by the end of 6 weeks, shrinking your girth in the process. Another reason for belly bloat
might be leftover fluids, which should be getting flushed out soon. And then there are those stretched out abdominal muscles and skin, which will likely take some effort to tone up, plus a few extra fat stores that help nurture your baby during pregnancy and are still nurturing baby if you're breastfeeding. As hard as it might be to put it out of your mind, don't even think about the shape your body's in during the first 6 weeks, especially if you're breastfeeding. This is a recovery period during which ample nutrition is important for your energy, mood, resistance to infection, and general well-being. Sticking to a healthy postpartum diet should start you on the way to slow, steady weight loss for now. If after 6 weeks you aren't losing any weight, you can start cutting back sensibly on calories. If you're breastfeeding, don't go overboard. Eating too few calories can reduce milk production, and burning fat too quickly can release toxins into the blood, which can end up in your breast milk. If you're not breastfeeding, you can aim to lose weight somewhat faster once you've passed the 6 week mark, but stick to diets that are well balanced and provide enough calories to fuel the energy every new mom needs. Some women find that the extra pounds melt off while they're breastfeeding, while others are bummed to find the scale doesn't budge. If the latter turns out to be the case with you, don't worry. You'll be able to shed any remaining weight once you've weaned your baby. How quickly you return to your pre-pregnant weight will also depend on how many pounds you put on during pregnancy. If you didn't gain much more than 25 to 35 pounds, you'll likely be able to pack away those maternity genes in a few months without strenuous dieting. If you gain 35 or more pounds, you may find it takes more effort and more time, anywhere from 10 months to 2 years, to return to pre-pregnancy weight and your skinny jeans. Either way, give yourself a break and give yourself some time. Remember, it took you 9 months to gain that pregnancy weight, and it may take at least that long to take it off. C-section recovery continued.
It's been a week since my C-section. What can I expect now?
While you've definitely come a long way since you were wheeled into recovery, like every new mom, you're still in recovery mode. And like every mom who's had a C-section, you're recovering not only from pregnancy and childbirth, but from surgery. You'll recover faster if you follow your doctor's instructions both for post-op and for all those things new moms aren't known for in general. Getting enough rest and not overdoing it comes to mind. In the meantime, you can expect progressive improvement in pain. Most of the pain should dissipate by the end of the first 6 weeks, though some moms experience occasional pain and other twinges much longer, even months later. Your scar will be sore and sensitive for the first few weeks, but it should improve steadily. Occasional sensations of pulling or twitching and other brief pains around the incision site are a normal part of healing and eventually subside. Itchiness around or on the scar, another normal if extra annoying part of the healing process, may follow. If it does, ask your practitioner to recommend an anti-itch ointment that you can apply. The numbness surrounding the scar will last longer, possibly several months. Lumpiness in the scar tissue will probably diminish, and the scar may turn pink or purplish before it finally fades. Narcotics during the first 2 weeks after birth are considered okay in safe doses if you feel you need them, but acetaminophen, Tylenol, or ibuprofen, Advil, should do the trick after the first week. So try to wean yourself off any pain meds as quickly as you're able, especially if you're breastfeeding. If the pain at the incision site gets worse, or if the area around the incision turns an angry red, or if a brown, gray, green, or yellow discharge oozes from the wound, call your doctor. The incision may have become infected. A small amount of clear fluid discharge is usually normal, but report it to your doctor anyway. You may find that wearing a belly band or other type of postpartum support system can help minimize pain while giving support to your healing incision and shrinking abdomen. A 4 week wait, at least, for sex. The guidelines are pretty much the same as they are for those who've delivered vaginally. Yes, even though your baby didn't exit vaginally, though how well your incision is healing may also be factored into how long you'll need to wait. To get moving, ease your way back to exercise with a 5-minute walk a few times a week, starting as soon as you feel up to it, building up to low impact workouts after the first 5 to 6 weeks. Once you re-enter the world of workouts, do it gradually, building up as your stamina does, but also try for consistency. If you're looking for results, occasional workouts won't cut it. As you're working your way back to your old exercise routine, concentrate on exercises that tighten the abs, but be sure to start off slow. Expect it to take several months at least before you're able to work out the way you did pre-baby. And remember, Kegels are still important, even if you delivered with your perineum intact, because pregnancy took its toll on those pelvic floor muscles, even if childbirth didn't. Breast infection.
I've got a lot of pain and redness in one of my breasts, and I'm running a fever. Do I have an infection?
Sounds like Mama has mastitis, a breast infection that can happen anytime during lactation, but is most common between the second and sixth week postpartum. What causes it? Often a combination of germs entering the milk ducts through a crack in the nipple, failure to drain breasts at each nursing, and lowered resistance in mom due to stress and fatigue. The most common symptoms of mastitis are severe soreness or pain, hardness, redness, heat, and swelling of the breast over the affected duct, plus flu-like symptoms, chills, and a fever of about 101 to 102, though occasionally the only symptoms are fever and fatigue. If you develop such symptoms, contact your doctor right away. Prompt medical treatment is necessary and may include bed rest, antibiotics, pain relievers, increased fluid intake, and heat applications. You should begin to feel drastically better within 36 to 48 hours after beginning the antibiotics. If you don't, let your practitioner know. He or she may need to prescribe a different type of antibiotic. Finish up the entire prescription unless you're advised not to or prescribed a different one. Taking probiotics during the course of antibiotics, though not at the same time of day, will help prevent yeast infection and thrush. Continue to breastfeed during treatment. The antibiotics prescribed for the infection will be safe during breastfeeding, and draining the breast will help prevent clogged milk ducts. Breastfeed on the infected breast if you can handle the pain and express whatever baby doesn't finish. If the pain is so bad that you can't nurse from the affected breast at all, see if pumping to drain it is tolerable. Delay in treating mastitis or discontinuing treatment too soon could lead to the development of a breast abscess, the symptoms of which include excruciating throbbing pain, localized swelling, tenderness, and heat in the area of the abscess, and temperature swings between 100 and 103 degrees. Treatment includes antibiotics and, frequently, surgical drainage under local anesthesia. Breastfeeding on that breast may be able to be continued depending on the location of the abscess, but in many cases, it won't be possible. But you can keep nursing with the other breast until you wean your baby.
Feeling down with letdown. There's nothing more joyful than putting your baby to breast. That rush of oxytocin, the feel-good hormone, as it courses through your veins, filling your baby with nourishment and you with blissful, peaceful pleasure. But what if that's not what you feel at all each time baby latches on? What if you feel, instead of that expected happiness and serenity, a fleeting moment of sadness, agitation, dread, guilt, anger, or resentment? Feelings that pass quickly but leave you unsettled, wondering what could be triggering such an unexpected response to breastfeeding. It's little known and discussed, but a small percentage of breastfeeding moms suffer from dysphoric milk ejection reflex, DEMR, a rare condition in which the milk letdown reflex itself brings on a range of negative emotions. The emotions begin immediately before the milk lets down and last anywhere from 30 seconds to a few minutes. Experts say DEMR isn't psychological, it's not an aversion to breastfeeding, and it's not related to postpartum depression. Rather, it's a physiological, hormonal response related to the sudden decrease in the brain chemical dopamine, responsible for mood stabilizing and happy thoughts, immediately before milk letdown. So what can you do if you're experiencing DEMR? First, know that the condition will pass, gradually improving and eventually disappearing, likely by the time baby's 6 months old. Second, remember that those negative emotions don't represent your true feelings. They're just a momentary hormonal response. Moms with DMER, unlike moms with PPD, feel fine throughout the rest of the day. Understanding what is happening and reminding yourself that it's very temporary can help you cope with DMER. It may also help to keep track of those surges of negative feelings to see whether there's a pattern of intensity to them. Maybe they come on more strongly when you're dehydrated or extra tired, and whether there are proactive steps you can take to ease them. Third, ask your practitioner if there are any therapies, such as breastfeeding-safe herbal remedies, acupuncture, or dietary changes that might help. Exercise can boost dopamine levels naturally, which means that taking a walk with baby before feeds may give you a lift during letdown. Finally, reach out to your social media mom network to see if you can find other moms who have experienced the symptoms of DMER. As always, knowing that you're not alone in what you're feeling can be incredibly reassuring.
Resuming sex.
I've heard a lot of different answers to this question, but when can we start having sex again?
That's at least partly up to you, though you'll also want to include your practitioner in the decision, probably not in the heat of the moment. Couples are typically advised to pick up where they left off sex-wise whenever the woman feels physically ready, usually around 4 weeks postpartum, though some practitioners give the green light to sex as early as 2 weeks postpartum, and others still follow the old 6-week rule routinely. In certain circumstances, for instance, if healing has been slow or you had an infection, your practitioner may recommend waiting longer. If your practitioner still has you in a holding pattern, but you think you're ready to move forward, ask if there's a reason why you shouldn't, and if there isn't, whether you can get busy earlier. If it turns out there is a reason, hold off and wait for clearance. Keep in mind that time will fly when you're caring for a newborn. In the meantime, assuming you're in the mood, satisfy each other with lovemaking that doesn't involve penetration.
My midwife told us we can start having sex, but I'm afraid it's going to hurt. Plus, to be honest, I'm really not in the mood.
Doing it isn't topping your to-do list these days, or more likely, isn't even making the top 20. No surprise there, or down there. Most women lose that loving feeling during the postpartum period and beyond for a variety of reasons. First, as you already suspect, postpartum sex can be more pain than pleasure, especially if you delivered vaginally, but surprisingly, even if you labored and then had a C-section. After all, your vagina has been stretched to its earthly limits and possibly torn or surgically cut and sutured to boot, leaving you to sort of sit, never mind contemplate sex. Adding to the pain potential no matter which exit your baby took, low levels of estrogen cause the vaginal tissue to remain thin, and thin is not in as far as vaginas are concerned. And your natural lubrications haven't turned on yet, making you feel uncomfortably dry where you'd rather be moist, especially if you're breastfeeding. Breastfeeding hormones can keep you dry longer. But your libido has other problems to contend with postpartum besides the physical ones. Your understandable preoccupation with a very little and very needy person who is given to waking up with a full diaper and an empty tummy at the least opportune times. Not to mention a number of other very effective mood killers, the pungent smell of day-old spit up on your sheets, the pile of dirty baby clothes at the foot of your bed, the baby massage oil on your nightstand where there used to be couples massage oil, the fact that you can't remember when you had your last shower. It's no wonder sex isn't on the schedule or even on your mind. Will you ever live to make love again? Absolutely. Like everything else in your new and often overwhelming life, it'll just take time and patience from your partner, too, who may already be ready for this dry spell to end. Or not. So wait until you're feeling ready, or help yourself get ready with the following tips. Lubricate. Using KY or another lubricant until your own natural secretions return can reduce pain and ideally increase pleasure. Buy them in economy sizes so you'll be more likely to use them liberally on both of you. Loosen up. Speaking of lubrication, drinking a small glass of wine can also help you unwind, and keep you from tensing up and experiencing pain during sex. Just make sure you sip it right after a feeding if you're nursing. Another great way to loosen up is massage, so request one before closing the deal. Warm up. Your partner may be as eager as he's ever been to get down to business, but though he's not likely to need much, if any, foreplay, you definitely do. So ask for it, and then ask for some more. The greater the effort he puts into warming you up, time permitting before baby wakes up again, the better the main event will be for both of you. Tell it like it is. You know what hurts and what feels good, but your partner doesn't unless you provide him with clearly marked route guidance. Turn left, no right, no, down, up just a smidge, there, perfect. So speak up when you'd like things to heat up. Position properly. Experiment and find a position that puts less pressure on any tender areas and gives you control over the depth of penetration. This is one time when deeper will definitely not be better. Woman on top if you have the energy, or side-to-side positions are both great postpartum picks for those reasons. Whoever's in charge of the strides, make sure they're performed at a comfortably slow speed. Pump it up. No, not that kind of pumping. Pump blood and restore muscle tone to your vagina by doing the exercise you're probably sick of hearing about, but should keep doing anyway. Kegels. Do them day and night, and don't forget to do them when you're doing it too, since that squeeze can please you both. Find alternative means of gratification. If you're not having fun yet through intercourse, seek sexual satisfaction through gentle for you, mutual masturbation, or oral sex, ditto. If you're both too pooped to pop, find pleasure and intimacy in just being together. There's absolutely nothing wrong and everything right about lying in bed together and cuddling. Bottom line and your postpartum bottom line, even if sex does hurt a bit the first time and second and third time, don't write it off or give it up. It won't be long, though it may seem that way, before the pleasure will be all yours and your partner's again. One more step before you resume sex, make sure you're all squared away with birth control.
For dads, postpartum sex? So maybe you're experiencing the longest sexual dry spell you've had since freshman year, and you're pretty sure you're exhibiting the symptoms of dreaded DSB, deadly semen backup. You're as ready for action as you've ever been, but action may not be in your partner's plans right now. And you get that. After all, she's recovering from a significant shock to her system, not just birthing, but the 9 months preceding. She's been through the ringer physically, and you feel for her, even if you don't literally feel her pain. You probably even hesitate to bring up sex. The doctor or midwife may have already said that sex is technically okay to start up again, but understandably, your partner and her body may have a different timetable in mind. As in, sex is tabled until she changes her mind. And she will, eventually. Once she does agree to give postpartum sex a try, and even if she's just as eager as you, or even more eager, to resume where you last left off, proceed very slowly and extremely gently. Ask her what feels good, what hurts, what you can do to help. Keep in mind that you'll need to serve up lots of tender foreplay appetizers before you even consider laying into the main course, both to get her in the mood and help her get her juices going. She'll be dry due to hormonal changes, so extra lubrication will be helpful too. Don't be surprised if you get an accidental eyeful of milk right in the middle of the action. Milk happens, especially early on. Share a laugh and get back to business. Or maybe the issue with getting back into the sack isn't with her, but with you? Perhaps you're hesitant to hitch a ride on the sex bandwagon because being a new parent is making you feel incredibly happy but distinctly unsexy? Many brand new dads find both the spirit and the flesh somewhat less willing after delivery. Although there's nothing abnormal about those who don't, for many very understandable reasons. Fatigue, fear that baby will wake up and cut you off at first base, or when you're trying to steal second. Unease about having sex so nearby your newborn, particularly if he or she is sharing your room. Concern that you may hurt your spouse by having sex before her body is completely healed. And finally, a general physical and mental preoccupation with your newborn, which sensibly concentrates your energies and interests where they are most needed at this stage of your lives. Your feelings may also be influenced by the temporary increase in estrogen and drop in testosterone that many new fathers experience, because it's testosterone in both women and men that fuels libido. That's probably nature's way of helping you nurture, and nature's way of helping keep sex off your mind when there's a new baby in the house. Though keep in mind, being in the mood for sex doesn't make you less of a nurturer. Remember, as with all matters sexual, there is a wide range of normal. For some couples, desire precedes even the practitioner's go-ahead. For others, 6 months can pass before sex makes a postpartum comeback. Some moms find their libidos lacking until they stop breastfeeding, but that doesn't mean they can't enjoy the closeness of lovemaking. While you're waiting for your libidos, yours, hers, or both, to make their inevitable return, and they will, make sure you're paying your partner plenty of the attention she's undoubtedly in need of. Even if she's not in the mood for love, she's definitely in the mood to hear that you love her and think she's beautiful and sexy. It can't hurt either to try some romantic moves to get you both back into the mood, as challenging as that might be to accomplish when you've got a newborn in the house. Light some scented candles once baby's finally asleep to mask that pervasive aroma of dirty diapers. Offer her a sensuous but no strings attached massage. Bring on the cuddles while you're both collapsed on the couch. Who knows? You might both feel that libido return sooner than you'd think.
Breastfeeding as birth control.
I've heard that breastfeeding keeps you from getting pregnant. Is that true?
Breastfeeding is a form of birth control, just not the most reliable one. So unless you don't mind becoming pregnant again soon, it's best not to bet on lactation for contraception, or at least not to put all your contraceptive eggs in the breastfeeding basket. It's true that on average, women who breastfeed resume normal cycles later than those who don't, a sign that, on average, they're not fertile as fast. In moms who aren't nursing, periods usually kick in again between 6 and 12 weeks after delivery, while in nursing moms, the average is between 4 and 6 months. As usual, however, averages don't tell the whole story. Nursing moms have been known to begin their periods as early as 6 weeks or as late as 18 months after giving birth. Though there's no way to predict where you'll fall on that first period timetable, several variables can offer clues. For example, frequency of nursing, more than 3 times a day, seems to suppress ovulation better. Duration of nursing, the longer you continue, the longer the delay in ovulation. And whether you're breastfeeding exclusively or supplementing, giving baby formula or solids can interfere with the ovulation suppressing effect. Which means that while it's a far from sure thing, the odds are pretty good that you won't get pregnant again right away if you're exclusively breastfeeding, feeding frequently, and haven't gotten your period yet. So why worry about using birth control, at least until you get that first postpartum period? Because the timetable for first postpartum ovulation is as unpredictable as the timetable for first postpartum period. Some women have a sterile first period, that is, they don't ovulate during that initial cycle. Others ovulate before having a period, which means they could conceivably go from pregnancy to pregnancy without ever unpacking the tampons. Since you don't know which will come first, the period or the egg, contraception makes sense if you're hoping to plan your next pregnancy. Birth control options.
I'm definitely not ready to have another baby yet. What are my options for birth control?
Okay, maybe sex isn't the first thing on your mind these days, and these sleep-deprived nights. Maybe it's the last thing on your mind most of the time. Yet there will come a night, or a Sunday afternoon when baby's napping, when you'll get the urge to sweep the pacifiers and burping cloths off the bed and sweep each other off your feet, when lust will return to your life and passion will pick up where it left off, approximately pre-baby. So be prepared. If you'd like to avoid back-to-back pregnancies, you'll need to use some form of birth control as soon as you begin having sex again. And because you never know when that urge might strike, it's good to have that birth control in hand or by your bed well in advance. Unless you're a gambling twosome, counting on breastfeeding to provide birth control is dicey. In other words, you'll want to consider a more reliable form of birth control, and there are plenty to choose from, even if you're a breastfeeding mom. There might even be some new options on the market since the last time you picked a birth control method, or ones that better fit your needs now. Before you decide on which form of contraception is best for you, listen up to all the following methods and discuss them with your partner and practitioner. Each of the methods has its benefits and drawbacks, depending on your medical and gynecological history, your lifestyle, whether you want to become pregnant again in the future, and how certain you want to be about avoiding pregnancy in the meantime, your practitioner's recommendation, and your feelings and your partner's. All of these methods are effective when used correctly and consistently, though some offer more reliable results than others. Oral contraception. Available in most states by prescription only, a few states allow over-the-counter sales. Oral contraception, OC, or the pill, is among the most effective non-permanent methods of birth control, with a success rate of about 99.5%. Most failures are due to a user's missing a day or taking pills in the wrong order. Another plus, it allows for spontaneity in sex. There are two basic types of oral contraception: combination pills, which contain both estrogen and progestin-only pills, mini pills. Both work by preventing ovulation and by thickening cervical mucus to keep sperm from reaching an egg should one be released. They also prevent a fertilized egg from implanting in the uterus. The combination pills are slightly more effective in preventing pregnancy than the minis. For maximum effectiveness, the mini pills must be taken at the same time every day. Combination pills have a slightly longer window. Some women experience side effects from OC, which vary depending on the pill. Most commonly, fluid retention, weight changes, nausea, breast tenderness, an increase or decrease in sex drive, hair loss, and menstrual irregularities. After the first few cycles of pill use, side effects often diminish or disappear completely. In general, today's oral contraceptives trigger fewer side effects than OC did years ago. Some versions of the pill, Yasmin, Cyclassa, deliver constant levels of estrogen and a new type of progestin. These are called monophasic pills, or use three different levels of estrogen and progestin, called triphasic, to reduce bloating and PMS. Another option that may be especially appealing to women who aren't fond of their monthly flow is Seasonale. It comes in a package with 84 hormone pills and 7 inactive pills. Women take the hormones for 12 weeks straight before taking a break for their period, which then comes only 4 times a year. Some women, however, experience more breakthrough bleeding with Seasonale than with monthly pills. Most doctors agree that it's safe to take any monophasic pill continually by skipping the inactive pills to avoid having a monthly period altogether. Women who are over age 35 and heavy smokers may be at increased risk of serious side effects, such as blood clots, heart attack, or stroke from OC. The pill may also be unsuitable for women with certain medical conditions, including a history of blood clots, diabetes, hypertension, and certain types of cancer. And OC sometimes is less effective in overweight or obese women. On the plus side, OC appears to protect against a whole host of conditions, including ovarian and uterine cancer. Other benefits experienced by some women who take OC are diminished PMS, very regular periods, and for certain varieties, clearer skin. There is some controversy about whether OC affects your breast cancer risk, so talk to your doctor about any concerns you may have, especially if there's a family history of premenopausal breast cancer. If you're planning to have another baby, fertility may take longer to return if you're using OC than if you're using a barrier contraceptive. Ideally, you should switch to a barrier method about 3 months before the time you plan to start TTC, trying to conceive. About 80% of women ovulate within the first 3 months after stopping the pill, 95% within a year. If you decide to try OC or go back to it, your doctor will help you determine which type and which dose is best for you based on whether you're breastfeeding Oral contraception containing estrogen is not recommended during breastfeeding, so nursing moms are limited to a progestin-only pill, aka the mini pill, as well as on your menstrual cycle, weight, age, and medical history. Making sure the pill works the way it's supposed to is up to you, so take it as prescribed. If you miss even one pill, or if you have diarrhea or vomiting, which can interfere with absorption of OC by your body, use backup protection, such as a condom, until your next period. See your doctor every 6 months to 1 year for monitoring of your health. Report any problems or signs of complications that show up between visits, and be sure to inform anyone prescribing medication of any kind that you are on oral contraception. Some herbs and medications, such as antibiotics, interact adversely with OC, making it less effective. The pill doesn't protect against STDs, so use a condom too if there's a chance of contracting an STD from your partner. OC increases the need for B6, B12, C, riboflavin, zinc, and folic acid. It reduces the need for other nutrients, so continue taking your prenatal or a breastfeeding supplement while on the pill. Injection. Hormonal injection, such as Depo-Provera, is a highly effective method of birth control, with a success rate of 99.7%. That stops ovulation and thickens cervical mucus to keep sperm and egg from meeting. The shot, given in the arm or buttock, is effective for 3 months. Depo-Provera is a progestin-only injection, so it is safe for breastfeeding moms. As with oral contraception, side effects of hormonal injections can include irregular periods, weight gain, and bloating. For some women, periods become fewer and lighter, and many women will have no periods while using Depo-Provera. Other women might experience longer and heavier periods. And like OC, the shot is not for every woman, depending on her specific health and medical condition, and it doesn't protect against STDs. The greatest advantage to the shot is that it prevents pregnancy for 12 weeks, and this can be compelling for someone who doesn't like to have to think about birth control or who often forgets to take a pill or insert a diaphragm. It also protects against endometrial and ovarian cancers, but there are disadvantages too. Having to return to your practitioner every 12 weeks for another shot, the fact that the effects of the shot can't be immediately reversed if you suddenly want a TTC, and that it may take up to a year for fertility to return after you stop Depo-Provera. Patch. The OrthoEvra patch, a matchbox-size adhesive patch, delivers the same hormones as the combination pill, but in patch form. Unlike OC, the patch maintains a steady state of hormonal levels because it continuously delivers hormones through the skin. The patch is worn for 1 week at a time and is replaced on the same day of the week for 3 consecutive weeks. You can use an app or an alarm on your phone as a reminder. The 4th week is patch-free, during which you'll get your period. The patch can be changed any time of the day. If you forget to change the patch and leave it on beyond the 7 days, the hormones are still effective for an additional 2 days. Most women choose to wear the patch on their abdomen or bottom. It can also be worn on the upper torso, excluding the breasts, the back, or the upper outer arm. Since the patch isn't affected by moisture, humidity, temperature, or activity, it can be worn in any weather, when showering or working out, even in a sauna or hot tub. Like other hormonal contraceptives, the patch is highly effective, about 99.5%. It may be less effective in overweight or obese women. Side effects are similar to those of OC, but there may be a greater risk of blood clots with the patch. It does not protect against STDs. Ring. The Nuva ring is a small, about the size of a silver dollar, transparent, flexible plastic ring that can flatten like a rubber band, be inserted into the vagina, and left in place for 21 days. Once inserted, the ring releases a steady flow of low doses of estrogen and progestin. The exact positioning of the ring inside the vagina isn't key to effectiveness because it's not a barrier method of birth control. You you can easily insert the ring yourself once a month. You won't feel it once it's inserted, and neither will your partner during sex. Once you remove it, again, easily, you'll get your last period. Then 1 week after the last one was removed, you'll insert a new ring, even if your period hasn't stopped yet. If you're likely to have trouble remembering the monthly insertion, a calendar reminder or app can keep you on track. Studies show that the level of cycle control with the NuvaRing is better than that with OC, which means there's little breakthrough bleeding. Because the hormones are the same as those used in the combination pills, side effects are generally the same, and those women who are advised not to use OC are also advised not to use contraceptive rings. The ring is also not for breastfeeding moms. It has a success rate of about 99% and is a good choice for obese women. The NuvaRing does not protect against STDs. Implant. The under-the-skin progestin implant has been shown to be a safe and effective method of birth control, with a success rate of about 99.9%, though the method may be less effective in obese women. Nexplanon is a single, flexible plastic rod about the size of a matchstick that is implanted under the skin of the upper arm. It releases a low, steady dose of progestin to thicken cervical mucus and thin the lining of the uterus, as well as stop ovulation. The implant is safe during breastfeeding, and it can prevent pregnancy for up to 3 years. The most common side effect is irregular bleeding, especially in the first 6 to 12 months of use. Most women find their periods become fewer and lighter, though some have longer, heavier periods, and some women stop having periods completely. Serious problems with Nexplanon are rare. It does not protect against STDs. IUD, intrauterine device. The IUD is the most widely used reversible birth control method for women in the world, but not so in the U.S., where only 11% of women using contraception opt for it, which is surprising since today's IUDs are considered among the safest methods of birth control and are just as effective as sterilization, over 99%. They're also the most convenient and, for most women, trouble-free. Definitely worth considering. An IUD is a small plastic device that is inserted into a woman's uterus by her GYN provider and can be left in place, effectively preventing pregnancy, for a number of years, depending on the type of IUD. There are two types of IUDs. The Paragard copper IUD releases copper in the uterus to immobilize sperm and also prevents implantation. This long-lasting IUD can be left in for 10 years. Talk about set it and forget it. The Mirena IUD releases progestin into the uterine walls, thickening cervical mucus and blocking sperm, while also preventing implantation. It lasts for 5 years, still a pretty good chunk of protected time. The major advantage of an IUD is that it offers the ultimate inconvenience. Once it is inserted, which, by the way, can happen anytime you'd like, including right after your vaginal or cesarean delivery or at your 6-week postpartum checkup, it needs absolutely no maintenance except to check routinely. Monthly is a good idea for the string attached to it. This allows for a completely spontaneous sex life with no pausing to find and insert a diaphragm or put on a condom or remembering to take a daily pill. Another plus, the IUD does not interfere with breastfeeding, and the hormones in the Mirena are safe for a breastfeeding baby. You can increase the already excellent protection from pregnancy provided by the IUD if you use condoms and/or spermicides for the first 2 to 3 months after insertion, when most failures, which are rare to begin with, occur. The IUD should not be used by a woman who has untreated gonorrhea or chlamydia. It should also not be used by a woman with active pelvic inflammatory disease, PID, known or suspected uterine or cervical malignancy or premalignancy, or abnormalities of the uterus or an unusually small uterus. Ask your doctor about the safety of an IUD if you or your partner have an STD. An allergy or suspected allergy to copper rules out the use of a copper IUD. Possible complications include cramping, which can be mild to moderate during insertion and rarely for a few hours or even days following. Uterine perforation, extremely rare, accidental expulsion, it might go unnoticed and leave you unprotected, and tubal or pelvic infections, also rare. Having an IUD in place does not increase the risk of an ectopic pregnancy. Some women may experience spotting between periods during the first few months after insertion. The first few periods may also last longer and be heavier. It's also not unusual for a woman to continue having heavier and longer periods while using an IUD. Mirena may lessen the amount of bleeding. Most women find their periods get lighter or disappear completely with the Mirena. Keep in mind that IUDs don't protect against STDs. Diaphragm. The diaphragm is a barrier method of birth control, a dome-shaped rubber cap that's placed over the cervix before sex to block the entry of sperm. It's 94% effective when used properly, meaning it's the right size, it's inserted properly, and it doesn't slip, along with a spermicidal gel meant to inactivate any sperm that might slip past the barrier. Aside from possible increases in urinary tract infections and an occasional allergic reaction triggered by either the spermicide or the rubber, the diaphragm is safe. In fact, used with the spermicide, it appears to reduce the risk of pelvic infections that can lead to infertility, though it doesn't protect against STDs. It in no way affects breastfeeding. With the diaphragm, size absolutely matters. It must be prescribed and fitted by a medical professional and refitted after every delivery, since pregnancy and childbirth change the size and shape of the cervix. As for the spontaneity factor, the diaphragm doesn't exactly get high marks. You have to stop to insert it or insert it before things get started, then check to make sure it's properly inserted before each sex session, unless you'll be having an encore sexual performance within a few hours, in which case you just need to add more spermicide. The diaphragm then has to be left in place for at least 6 to 8 hours after sex, but no longer than 24 hours in a row. Some experts suggest it's probably prudent to remove it within 12 to 18 hours, and some recommend women insert their diaphragms as part of their bedtime routines so they don't forget or neglect to use it in a moment of passion. Though again, it can't be kept in place for more than 24 hours at a time. Either way, there's lots of keeping track and clock watching, and there's maintenance involved too, cleaning the diaphragm after use, storing it properly in its case, not loose in the bottom of your purse or in your jeans pocket, and checking it regularly for holes by holding it up to a light. Cervical cap. The cervical cap is similar to the diaphragm in many ways. It must be fitted by a medical professional, must be used with a spermicide, and does its job by acting as a barrier to sperm. Its success at preventing pregnancy is lower than the diaphragm's, approximately 60 to 75%, but it does offer a couple of advantages. Shaped like a large thimble, the pliable rubber cap has a firm rim that fits snugly around the cervix, making it only about half the size of the diaphragm. A convenience plus, instead of the 24-hour outside limit recommended for the diaphragm, the cap can be left in place for 48 hours, though an unpleasant odor can develop when it's left in that long. The FemCap, another type of cervical cap with a success rate of 85%, is a silicone dome shaped like a sailor's hat. It comes in three sizes and fits over the cervix with a brim that seals against the vaginal walls and has a groove that stores the spermicide and traps the sperm. It also has a removal strap. Vaginal sponge. The Today sponge, which covers the cervix and blocks sperm from entering the uterus, while also continuously releasing a spermicide that keeps sperm from moving, is made of plastic foam. It is soft, round, and about 2 inches in diameter, with a nylon loop attached to the bottom for removal. The upsides to the sponge, it doesn't require a visit to the doctor or a prescription, is relatively easy to use, provides continuous protection for a full 24 hours after insertion, and has no effect on breastfeeding. On the downside, it's somewhat less effective than the diaphragm, about 80%, can increase the risk of yeast infections, and can be uncomfortable to insert. It should not be left in longer than recommended, and you'll need to check carefully to make sure the whole sponge is removed intact. A piece left behind could cause odor and infection. The sponge also can't be reused, so you'll have to stay stocked up. Condom. Also called a rubber, a condom, as you probably know, is essentially a penis cover designed to trap sperm when they're ejaculated so they can't gain access into the vagina. It's made of latex or natural skin from the intestines of a sheep, and if used consistently and correctly, it's a pretty effective birth control method with a success rate of 98%. The condom is totally harmless, that is, unless one or both partners has an allergic reaction to the latex material, or the spermicide, if latex is an issue, opt for the natural skin. It has the advantage of being easily available and portable for on-the-fly activities, and of reducing the risk of transmitting STDs such as gonorrhea, chlamydia, and HIV. The latex variety is better at preventing transmission of HIV, as well as the Zika virus. Because it in no way interferes with breastfeeding, and because it clearly doesn't require postpartum refitting, as does the diaphragm, it is an ideal transitional method. Some couples find that condoms get in the way of spontaneous fun, especially because you have to wait until erection to put it on. And some find it decreases sensitivity and or causes vaginal irritation, with more potential for irritation postpartum. Other couples don't mind condoms a bit and may even find a way to make putting it on part of foreplay. To increase effectiveness, you shouldn't linger long after sex when you're using a condom. The penis should be withdrawn before the erection is totally lost and while the condom is held on to avoid leakage of semen. The use of a lubricating cream or a lubricated condom will help slip the covered penis in more comfortably during those dry postpartum and breastfeeding months. But choose your lube with care. Don't use oil-based lubricants or Vaseline because they can damage a latex condom. Always check the instructions on the package before using an oil-based lubricant. Thought condoms kept only guys covered? There's one for you too. The female condom is a thin, lubricated polyurethane pouch that lines the vagina and is held in place by a closed inner ring near the cervix and an outer ring at the opening of the vagina. A female condom is inserted into the vagina up to 8 hours before intercourse and is removed right after. The downsides to the female condom, it is more expensive than the male condom, may prevent full sensation, and is clearly noticeable once in place. Plus, it's yet another birth control method that depends on a woman's compliance, unlike the male condom, which at least shares the load. And it's a little less effective than the male condom, about 95%. But like the male condom, it prevents STDs. Spermicide foams, creams, jellies, suppositories, and contraceptive films. Used alone, these anti-sperm agents are only so-so effective, approximately 72 to 94% at preventing pregnancy. They're available without a prescription, but can be messy and inconvenient. They can be inserted up to 1 hour before intercourse. Emergency contraception. The emergency contraception pill, ECP, is the only method of birth control that can be used after unprotected sex, or as a backup when your contraceptive method has failed, as with a broken condom, slipped diaphragm, or missed pills, but before a pregnancy is established. ECP is sold over-the-counter as Plan B One Step, Take Action, Next Choice One Dose, and My Way. Ella, another ECP, is available with a prescription. ECPs reduce a woman's risk of pregnancy by 75% when taken within 72 hours of unprotected sex. The sooner ECPs are taken after unprotected sex, the more effective they are. Your doctor might also recommend using ordinary birth control pills as emergency contraception, but check to confirm the dose you should use. Emergency contraception pills will not work if you're already pregnant. Important distinction. ECP is not a so-called abortion pill, like RU486. ECPs work mostly by temporarily stopping ovulation. ECPs are not recommended for use during the first 6 weeks postpartum because their high estrogen content can increase the risk of blood clots, and they are not recommended while breastfeeding. Sterilization. Sterilization is frequently the choice of couples who feel that their families are complete. don't have a problem with closing and locking the door to conception and are eager to dispense with contraception altogether. And who's not eager for that? It's increasingly safe with no known long-term health effects and virtually foolproof. The occasional failure can be attributed to a slip-up in surgery or, in the case of a vasectomy, not using alternative birth control until all viable sperm have been ejaculated. Though sterilization is sometimes reversible, it should be considered permanent. A vasectomy, the tying or cutting of the vasa deferentia, the tubes that transport sperm from testicles to penis, is an easy in-office procedure done with local anesthesia, and it carries far fewer risks than female sterilization. It doesn't, as some men fear, affect the ability to achieve erection or ejaculate. All that's missing is the sperm, not the semen. Research has also shown there is no increased risk of prostate cancer for men with vasectomies. Tubal ligation is a procedure done on women under regional or epidural anesthesia, right after delivery if you want, in which a small incision is made in the abdomen near the belly button or bikini line, and the fallopian tubes are cut, tied, or blocked. It does require some downtime, usually 2 days to a week, sometimes more, of only light activity for most women, which you're going to be adhering to anyway if you just delivered. Fertility awareness. Couples who prefer not to use contraception at all can opt for the fertility awareness method, FAM, aka natural family planning. This approach relies on becoming aware of a number of body signs or symptoms to determine the time of ovulation. If done perfectly correctly, the FAM approach can be just as successful at avoiding pregnancy as some other birth control methods in the 90% effectiveness range. So what makes for perfect practice of fertility awareness? The more factors a couple takes into consideration, the better the success rate. And there's a long list of factors, including cervical mucus changes, the mucus is clear, copious, thin, has an egg white consistency, and can be pulled into a long string at ovulation. Basal body temperature changes. The baseline temperature, measured first thing in the morning, drops slightly just before ovulation, reaches its lowest point at ovulation, and then immediately rises to a high point before returning to the baseline for the rest of the cycle. And cervical changes. The normally firm cervix becomes a little softer, and it's also slightly higher and more open than normal during ovulation. Ovulation predictor kits can also help to pinpoint ovulation, though using them every month to prevent pregnancy can get pretty pricey. Saliva tests for ovulation can also help some women predict when ovulation is about to happen and are more cost-effective. Once you're armed with all the ovulation information you need, the key will be avoiding sex from the first sign that you're about to ovulate until 3 days after.
More birth control options for you? The choices are limited when it comes to birth control for guys, but currently in clinical trials are some promising male contraceptive products. One is a topical hormone gel applied daily to the arms and shoulders that works by shutting down testosterone production in the testes. No testosterone in the testes means no sperm production. Another product, a male birth control pill or injection, also lowers testosterone in the testes, just enough to stop sperm production, but not enough to lower libido. A non-surgical and reversible form of vasectomy is also in trials now and showing promise. Eager to be an early adopter? Not so fast. Experts say it will be years before any of these methods hit the market. All about getting back into shape.
It's one thing to look 6 months pregnant when, in fact, you are 6 months pregnant, and another to look it when you've already delivered. Yet most new moms can expect to leave the birthing room with a little bundle in their arms and a sizable one still around their middles. How soon after you become a new mom will you stop looking like a mom-to-be? Genes will play a role in how quickly you'll slip back into your skinny jeans, as will your metabolism, how much weight you gain during pregnancy, and of course, your postpartum eating habits. But there's no getting around it. Getting back into shape and out of those baggy sweats will definitely take getting back into the exercise habit. Who needs exercise, you may wonder? I haven't stopped moving since I got home from the hospital. Doesn't that count? Unfortunately, not that much. Exhausting as it is caring for a newborn, that kind of activity won't tighten up the perineal and abdominal muscles that have been stretched and left saggy by pregnancy and childbirth. Only a regular workout program will, and the right kind of postpartum exercise will do more than tone you up. It will help keep baby-toting backaches at bay, promote healing and recovery from labor and delivery, help pregnancy loosen joints tighten up, and improve circulation. Kegel exercises, which target the perineal muscles, will help you avoid stress and urinary incontinence and postpartum sexual problems. Finally, exercise can make you happier, as exercise release endorphins circulate in your system, boosting your mood and your ability to cope. You'll find yourself much better equipped to handle the stresses of new parenthood and even beat back baby blues. In fact, research shows that moms who resume exercising within 6 weeks of delivery feel better about themselves and just plain feel better. Don't even think about starting off with a bang, though, even if you feel surprisingly well and mega motivated. Instead, ease your recovering body slowly and steadily back into workout mode with the following basic exercises. Supplement these with an online or DVD postpartum workout, take a class for new moms, or just make daily strolls or stroller size with baby a part of your daily routine.
Workout rules for the first 6 weeks. Wear a supportive bra and comfortable clothing, nothing that rubs on tender spots, traps moisture, or doesn't allow breathing room. Try to divide your exercise schedule into 2 or 3 brief sessions rather than doing a single long session a day. This tones muscles better and will be easier on your recovering body. Plus, you're more likely to be able to fit it in and keep it up. Start each session with the exercise you find least strenuous. Do exercises slowly and don't do a rapid series of repetitions. Instead, rest briefly between movements. The muscle buildup occurs then, not while you are in motion. Avoid jerky, bouncy, erratic motions during the first 6 weeks postpartum, while your ligaments are still loose. Also avoid knee-to-chest exercises, full sit-ups, and double leg lifts during this period. Keep a water bottle next to you during your workouts and sip often. Take it slowly and sensibly. No pain, no gain wasn't a motto created with new moms in mind. Don't do more than recommended, even if you feel you can, and stop before you feel tired. That is, more tired than being a new mom has already made you. If you overdo it, you probably won't feel it until the next day, by which time you may be so exhausted and achy that you won't be able to exercise at all. Plus, pushing yourself can actually slow your postpartum recovery. Don't let taking care of your baby stop you from taking care of yourself. Your baby will love lying on your chest as you go through your floor routine. Close the gap. Don't look now, but there might be a hole in the middle of your belly, and it's not your navel. A very common pregnancy condition known in obstetrical circles as diastasis, up to half of moms experience it. It's a gap in your abdominal muscles that can develop as the abdomen expands. It can take a month or two after delivery for this gap to close, and you'll have to wait until it does before you start those crunches and other abdominal exercises, or you'll risk an injury. To determine if you have a separation, examine yourself this way. Lie on your back, knees bent, soles flat on the floor. Support your head and shoulders with pillows and rest your arms flat at your sides. Raise your head slightly with your arms extended forward, then feel for a soft lump above your navel. Such a lump indicates a separation. If you do have a separation, you may be able to help correct it more quickly with this exercise. Lie on your back, knees bent, soles flat on the floor. Support your head and shoulders with pillows. Rest your arms flat at your sides and inhale. Cross your hands over your abdomen, using your fingers to draw the sides of your abdominal muscles together as you breathe out, pulling your belly button inward toward the spine while raising your head slowly. Exhale as you lower your head slowly. Repeat 3 or 4 times, twice a day.
first weeks after delivery. Eager to get that pre-baby body back, then you'll be happy to hear that it's time to step up to the exercise ladder. But before you take that step, make sure the pair of vertical muscles that form your abdominal wall have not separated during pregnancy. If they have, you'll have to close them up before the workouts start heating up. Once the separation has closed, or if you've never had one, you can work up to the following exercises. At first, do these exercises in bed, then move on to a well-cushioned floor or an exercise or yoga mat. Pelvic tilt. Lie on your back, knees bent, soles flat on the floor. Support your head and shoulders with pillows and rest your arms flat at your sides. Take a breath. Then exhale as you press the small of your back against the floor for 10 seconds. Then relax. Repeat 3 or 4 times to start, increasing gradually to 12 and then 24. Leg slides. Lie on your back, knees bent, soles flat on the floor. Support your head and shoulders with pillows and rest your arms flat at your sides. Slowly extend both legs until they are flat on the floor. Slide your right foot flat on the floor, back towards your buttocks, inhaling as you go. Keep the small of your back against the floor. Exhale as you slide your leg back down. Repeat with your left foot. Start with 3 or 4 slides per side and increase gradually until you can do a dozen or more comfortably. After 3 weeks, move to a modified leg lift, lifting one leg at a time slightly off the floor and lowering it again very slowly if it's comfortable. Head shoulder lift. Lie on your back, knees bent, soles flat on the floor. Support your head and shoulders with pillows and rest your arms flat at your sides. Take a deep, relaxing breath, then raise your head very slightly and stretch your arms out, exhaling as you do. Lower your head slowly and inhale. Raise your head a little more each day, gradually working up to lifting your shoulders slightly off the floor. Don't try full sit-ups during the first 6 weeks, and then only if you've always had very good abdominal muscle tone. Check first, too, for an abdominal separation. After your postpartum checkup. Now, with your practitioner's go-ahead, you can gradually graduate to a more active workout program that includes power walking, running, biking, swimming, water workouts, aerobics, yoga, Pilates, weight training, or similar routines, or sign up for a postpartum exercise class. But don't try to do too much too soon. As always, let your body be your guide. The fourth trimester. Thought you were done with trimesters and all those checkups? Maybe not. According to ACOG's paradigm of postpartum care, one that your practitioner may or may not follow and your insurance may or may not cover, all recently delivered moms should have contact, an office visit, a call, email, or text with their practitioner within the first 3 weeks after delivery. That initial checkup or check-in should be followed up with ongoing care, visits, or contact as needed, finishing up with a comprehensive office visit no later than 12 weeks postpartum. The reason for this fourth trimester? Experts have concluded that the 3 months after delivery are key for a mom's health and her baby's. There's also a time of many physical, social, and psychological changes and adjustments. This type of individualized ongoing care can help you navigate the transition to motherhood while making sure you're getting the medical care you need, especially important if you're having physical or emotional symptoms that need checking out.
Part 4. Staying healthy when you're expecting. Chapter 18. If you get sick.
So you were probably expecting to experience at least a few of the less pleasant pregnancy symptoms during your 9 months of expecting. A little morning sickness, a few leg cramps, some heartburn and fatigue. But maybe you weren't expecting to come down with a nasty cold or an ugly and itchy infection. The truth is, pregnant women can get sick with the best of them, actually even better than the best of them, since the normal suppression of the immune system, so mom's body doesn't reject her baby, is foreign, makes expectant moms easier targets for germs of every variety. What's more, being sick for two can make you at least twice as uncomfortable, especially since so many of the remedies you're used to reaching for may need to stay behind medicine cabinet doors for now. Prevention is, of course, the best way to avoid getting sick in the first place and to keep that healthy glow of pregnancy going strong. But when it fails, as when a coworker brings a stomach bug to the office, your nephew's wet kisses are sweet but saturated with cold germs, or you pick up some bacteria with those fresh-picked blueberries, quick treatment, in most cases under the supervision of your practitioner, can help you feel better fast.
What you may be wondering about if you get sick during pregnancy.
The common cold.
I'm sneezing and coughing and my head is killing me. What can I take that won't affect my baby?
Common colds are even more common when you're pregnant because your normal immune system is suppressed. The good news is that you're the only one those nasty bugs will be bugging. Your baby can't catch your cold or be affected by it in any way. The not-so-good news, the medications and supplements that you might be used to reaching for to find relief or to prevent a cold, including ibuprofen, extra doses of vitamin C and zinc, and herbals like echinacea, are usually off-limits when you're expecting. So before you pick the shelves of your local drugstore clean, pick up the phone and call your practitioner to find out which over-the-counter remedies are considered safe in pregnancy, as well as which will work best in your case. If you've already taken a few doses of a medication that isn't recommended for pregnancy use, don't worry, but do check with your practitioner for extra reassurance. Even if your standard cold remedy is shelved for now, you don't have to suffer with a runny nose and hacking cough. Some of the most effective cold remedies don't come in a bottle and are also the safest for both you and your baby. These tips can help nip a cold in the bud before it blossoms into a nasty case of sinusitis or another secondary infection, while helping you feel better faster. At the very first sneeze or tickle in the throat, rest if you need it. Taking a cold to bed doesn't necessarily shorten its duration, but if your body is begging for rest, be sure to listen, especially now that it's begging for two. On the other hand, if you feel up to it and you're not running a fever or coughing, light to moderate exercise can actually help you feel better faster. Feed your cold and your baby. Eat as well as you can, given how crummy you feel and how little appetite you probably have. Especially seek vitamin C-rich foods, like citrus and melon. Flood your cold with fluids. A runny nose can cost your body fluids you and your baby need. Warm fluids like ginger tea or chicken broth will be particularly soothing for your scratchy throat. Stay up even when you're lying down. Elevating your head with a couple of pillows will make it easier for you to breathe through a stuffy nose. Nasal strips, which gently pull your nasal passages open, making breathing easier, may help too. Or try decongesting with a vapor rub, like Vicks. Stay moist. Keeping your nasal passages moist will ease congestion, so run a humidifier, especially at night, and use saline nasal spray. It's drug-free, so you can use it as often as needed. Or saline rinses, but steer clear of neti pots since they're more apt to spread germs. Soothe with salt water. Gargling with warm salt water, 1/4 teaspoon of salt to 8 ounces of warm water, can ease a sore or scratchy throat, wash away postnasal drip, and help control a cough. Calm a dry cough the sweet way. A couple of teaspoons of honey can actually suppress the kind of dry cough that often comes with and after a cold as effectively as an OTC cough syrup. Honey's too sweet straight up? Mix it with hot water and lemon. Colds don't typically come with a fever, but if your temperature rises to over 100 degrees, bring it down promptly with acetaminophen, Tylenol, and call your practitioner. Also call if your cold is severe enough to interfere with eating or sleeping, if you're coughing up greenish or yellowish mucus, if you have a cough with chest pain or wheezing, if your sinuses are throbbing, or if symptoms last more than 10 to 14 days. It's possible that your cold has regressed to a secondary infection and that prescribed medication
may be needed. Sinusitis.
I've had a bad cold for more than 10 days. Now my forehead and cheeks are starting to really hurt. What should I do?
Sounds as if your nasty cold may have evolved into an even nastier case of sinusitis, an inflammation of the tissues lining your sinuses. In addition to a lingering or worsening stuffy nose, signs of sinusitis often include pain and tenderness in the forehead and/or in both cheeks beneath the eye, achiness around the teeth, and possibly a temporary loss of the sense of smell. The pain of sinusitis usually worsens when you bend over or shake your head. Fever sometimes accompanies these symptoms, but not always. Sinusitis following a cold is fairly common, but it is far more common among pregnant women. That's because pregnancy hormones tend to swell mucous membranes, including those in and leading to the sinuses, trapping air and mucus behind the narrow sinus openings and causing blockages that can allow germs to build up and multiply in the sinuses. These germs tend to linger longer there because immune cells, which destroy invading germs, have difficulty reaching the sinuses' deep recesses. As a result, the symptoms can persist for weeks or longer, becoming chronic. Most sinus infections are caused by viruses. Sometimes they're caused by allergies. But about 10% of the time, bacteria get the blame. If your sinus infection is caused by bacteria, often the case when your sinus symptoms are lingering for longer than 10 days, or if they're severe and accompanied by fever, your practitioner will prescribe a pregnancy-safe antibiotic to clear it up. If your sinusitis is caused by a virus, antibiotics won't be helpful, so treatment will focus on easing symptoms with pain relievers, nasal steroids, and nasal rinses. Some practitioners will okay limited use of certain decongestants after the first trimester. Flu season.
I usually get a flu shot in the fall, but now I'm wondering if I should skip it this year. Is it safe during pregnancy?
A flu shot is definitely your best line of defense during flu season. Not only is it safe to receive while you're pregnant, it's considered a very smart move. In fact, the CDC recommends that all moms-to-be get the flu shot. That's because the flu can be much more severe when you're expecting and is more likely to lead to serious complications requiring hospitalization. And since the CDC puts pregnant women at the top of the priority list, along with the elderly and children between the ages of 6 months and 5 years, moms-to-be can waddle to the front of the flu shot line, even if the vaccine is in short supply. Talk to your practitioner about getting a flu shot. Many OB practices offer it to pregnant patients. You can also stop by a flu shot clinic at your local pharmacy or supermarket. The flu vaccine offers the most protection if it's given before or early in each flu season, preferably by October. It's never 100% effective because it protects only against the flu viruses that are expected to cause the most problems in a particular year. Still, it greatly increases the chance that you will escape the season flu-free and H1N1-free too. And even when it doesn't prevent the flu, the vaccine usually reduces the severity of symptoms, which is extra important when you're expecting, since flu can hit pregnant women especially hard. Side effects occur infrequently and are generally mild. You'll have to stick with the needle when it comes to your seasonal flu vaccine, since the nasal spray vaccine, Flumist, which is made from live flu virus, is not approved for or given to pregnant women. If you suspect you might have the flu, symptoms include fever, achiness, headache, sore throat, and cough, call your doctor right away so that you can be treated and so that the flu doesn't progress to pneumonia. Treatment may include an antiviral medication, like Tamiflu, along with the steps aimed at reducing fever and other symptoms.
Flu shot for two. Getting a flu shot protects you when you're expecting, but did you know that its benefits carry over to your soon-to-be newborn as well? Researchers have found that babies born to moms who were given the flu shot during the last trimester of pregnancy appear to be protected against the virus until they're old enough to get their own shot at 6 months. Of course, if you're in the first or second trimester when flu season begins, don't wait to get your shot. You'll need to be protected throughout flu season.
fever.
I'm running a little fever. What should I do?
While a low-grade fever, one that's under 100 degrees, usually isn't something to worry about when you're expecting, it's also something you shouldn't ignore. So take steps to bring it down promptly, but also keep an eye on the thermometer to make sure the numbers don't start rising. If your fever reaches 100 degrees, call your practitioner the same day or the next morning if it's in the middle of the night. If it climbs to 101 degrees, call right away, even if it is the middle of the night. That's because not only could a fever that goes higher than that be harmful to your developing baby, especially if it happens during the first trimester, but also the cause of the fever, for instance, an infection that requires treatment, might be harmful even if the fever isn't. While you're waiting to speak to your practitioner, take acetaminophen, Tylenol, to start reducing the fever. Taking a tepid bath or shower, drinking cool beverages, and keeping clothing and covers light will also help bring your temperature down. Aspirin or ibuprofen, Advil or Motrin, should not be taken at any time during pregnancy unless they've been specifically recommended by your practitioner. Strep throat.
My preschooler came down with strep throat. If I catch it, is there a risk to the baby?
If there's one thing kids are good at sharing, it's their germs. And the more kids you have at home, especially of the daycare attending or school-going variety, the greater your chances of coming down with colds and other infections while you're expecting. So step up preventive measures, but if you do suspect that you've succumbed to strep, call your practitioner, who will likely run a throat culture. Strep infection won't hurt the baby as long as it's treated promptly with the right type of antibiotic, one that's effective and pregnancy safe. Don't take medication that was prescribed for your child or someone else in the family. Urinary tract infection.
I'm afraid I have a urinary tract infection.
Your poor battered bladder, which spends months on end being pummeled by your growing uterus and its adorable occupant, is the perfect breeding ground for less welcome visitors, bacteria. Those little bugs, which usually live quietly in your skin and in your feces, have an easier than usual time entering your urinary tract when you're expecting, thanks to the flood of muscle-relaxing hormones. Once there, bacteria make themselves at home and make you miserable, multiplying faster in areas where compression from your expanding uterus, the same compression that has you getting up to pee several times a night, has allowed urine to pool or flow slowly. In fact, urinary tract infections, UTIs, are so common in pregnancy that at least 5% of pregnant women can expect to develop at least one. And those who've already had one have a 1 in 3 chance of an encore. In some women, a UTI is silent, without symptoms, and diagnosed only after a routine urine culture. In others, symptoms can range from mild to quite uncomfortable, an urge to urinate frequently, pain or burning sensation when urine, sometimes only a drop or two, is passed, pressure or sharp pain in the lower abdominal area. The urine may also be foul-smelling and cloudy. Diagnosing a UTI is as simple as dipping a stick into a urine sample at your practitioner's office. The stick will react to red or white blood cells in the sample, both of which can indicate an infection. The urine will then be sent off to the lab for further analysis. Treating a UTI is simple too. Your practitioner will prescribe a course of pregnancy-safe antibiotics, specifically targeting the type of bacteria the lab finds in your urine. Of course, prevention is always the best strategy, but especially when you're expecting. Here are some steps you can take to prevent a UTI. You can also use them in conjunction with your prescribed treatment to help speed your recovery from an infection. Drink plenty of fluids, especially water, which can help flush out any bacteria. Cranberry juice may also be beneficial, possibly because the tannins it contains keep bacteria from sticking to urinary tract walls. Avoid coffee and tea, even decaffeinated, which may increase irritation. Wash your vaginal area well and empty your bladder just before and after sex. Every time you pee, take the time to empty your bladder thoroughly. Leaning forward on the toilet will help accomplish this. It sometimes also helps to double void. After you pee,
wait 5 minutes, then try to pee again. And don't put off the urge when you have it, since regularly holding it in increases susceptibility to infection. To give your perineal area breathing room, wear cotton crotch underwear and pantyhose. Avoid wearing tight pants or leggings. Don't wear pantyhose or tights under pants, and sleep without panties or PJ bottoms if possible and comfortable. Keep your vaginal and perineal areas meticulously clean and irritation-free. Wipe front to back after using the toilet to keep fecal bacteria from entering your vagina or urethra. Wash daily. Showers are better than baths. And avoid bubble bath and perfumed products, powders, shower gels, soaps, sprays, detergents, and toilet paper. Ask your practitioner about taking probiotics to help restore the balance of beneficial bacteria. UTIs in the lower part of the urinary tract are no fun, but a more serious potential risk is that bacteria from an untreated UTI will travel up to your kidneys. Kidney infections that aren't treated can be quite dangerous and may lead to premature labor, low birth weight, and other complications. The symptoms are the same as those of UTIs, but are frequently accompanied by fever, often as high as 103 degrees, chills, blood in the urine, backache, in the mid-back on one or both sides, nausea, and vomiting. If you experience these symptoms, notify your practitioner immediately so you can be treated promptly. Yeast infection.
I think I have a yeast infection. Should I go get some of the cream I usually use? Or do I need to see the doctor?
Pregnancy is never a time for self-diagnosis or treatment, not even when it comes to something as seemingly simple as a yeast infection. Even if you've had yeast infections 100 times before, even if you know the symptoms backward and forward, a yellowish, greenish, or thick and cheesy discharge that has a foul odor, accompanied by burning, itching, redness, or soreness, even if you treated yourself successfully with over-the-counter preparations in the past, this time around, call your practitioner. What kind of treatment you'll get will depend on what kind of infection you have. Something only lab tests can determine. If it does turn out to be a yeast infection, which is very common in pregnancy, your practitioner may prescribe vaginal suppositories, gels, ointments, or creams. The oral anti-yeast agent, fluconazole, Diflucan, may be prescribed if necessary, but only in low doses and for no longer than 2 days because of the possible increased risk of miscarriage at higher doses. Unfortunately, medication may banish a yeast infection only temporarily. The infection often returns off and on until after delivery and may require repeated treatment. You may be able to speed your recovery and prevent reinfection by staying as clean and dry as you can. Always wipe front to back, rinse your vaginal area thoroughly after soaping in the shower or bath. Showers are preferable. Skip perfumed soaps and bubble baths and anything else irritating. Wear cotton underwear, avoid tight pants or leggings, especially those that aren't cotton, and let the area breathe as much as possible. Sleep without underwear if you can. Eating yogurt containing live probiotic cultures may help keep those yeast bugs at bay. You can also ask your practitioner about taking an effective probiotic supplement. Some chronic yeast infection sufferers find that cutting down on foods yeast feeds on, like sugar and baked goods made with refined flour, helps as well. Do not douche because it upsets the normal balance of bacteria in the vagina, which may be linked to BV, bacterial vaginosis, and exposes you to harmful phthalates. Good reasons never to douche whether you're pregnant or not. You also don't need feminine vaginal wipes, but if you can't live without that fresh feeling, choose wipes that are chemical and alcohol-free, as well as pH-safe, since changing the pH of your natural juices could increase the risk of infection.
Bacterial vaginosis. Bacterial vaginosis, BV, is the most common vaginal condition in women of childbearing age, affecting more than 3/4 of all women and up to 16% of pregnant women. BV, which occurs when certain types of bacteria normally found in the vagina, begin to multiply in large numbers is often accompanied by an abnormal gray or white vaginal discharge with a strong fish-like odor, pain, itching, or burning, though some women with BV report no signs or symptoms at all. Experts are not exactly sure what causes the normal balance of bacteria in the vagina to be disrupted, though some risk factors have been identified, including having multiple sex partners, douching, or having an IUD. Why should you be concerned about something that's so common? It's because during pregnancy, BV is associated with a slight increase in complications, premature rupture of the membranes, for instance, or amniotic fluid infection, which may lead to premature labor. It may also be linked to a slight risk of miscarriage and low birth weight. Though it's unclear whether treating symptomatic BV with antibiotics during pregnancy decreases the risk of complications, most practitioners will treat anyway. Be sure to mention any symptoms you may have to your practitioner so you can get the right diagnosis and, if necessary, the right treatment.
Stomach bugs.
I've got a stomach bug, and I can't keep anything down. Will this hurt my baby?
Just when you thought it was safe to come out of the bathroom, you're back with a bug. Goodbye, morning sickness. Hello, stomach virus. And if you're still in your first trimester when the bug hits, it could be hard to differentiate the symptoms from those of morning sickness, unless you're also bugged by diarrhea. Luckily, having a stomach bug won't hurt your little one, just your stomach. But that doesn't mean it shouldn't be treated. And whether your tummy is turning from hormones, a virus, or egg salad that sat on the lunch cart too long, the treatment is the same. Get the rest your body's aching for and focus on fluids, especially if you're losing them through vomiting or diarrhea. They're much more important in the short term than solids are. If you're not urinating frequently enough or your urine is dark, it should be straw colored, you may be dehydrated. Fluid needs to be your best buddy now. Try taking frequent small sips of water, diluted juice, white grape is easiest on the tummy, clear broth, weak tea, or hot water with lemon. If you can't manage to sip, suck on ice chips or an ice pop. Follow your stomach's lead when it comes to adding solids, and when you do, keep it bland, simple, and fat-free. Dry toast, applesauce, bananas. And don't forget that ginger's good for what ails any sick stomach. Take it in tea or in flat ginger ale, best if there's actually real ginger in it, or another ginger beverage, or suck or chew on some ginger candies. Getting your vitamin insurance is an especially good idea now, so try to take your prenatal when it's least likely to come back up. A powder may go and stay down easier. Don't worry, however, if you just can't handle your prenatal for a few days or so. No harm done. If you can't get anything down, talk to your practitioner. Dehydration is a problem for anyone suffering with a stomach bug, but it's especially problematic if you're pregnant. You might be advised to take some rehydration fluid, like Pedialyte, which also comes in soothing freezable form, or Gatorade, or electrolyte water. Coconut water may be helpful too. If you can't keep even that down, your doctor might want you to come in for some IV fluids. Also call in if you're running a fever with those tummy troubles. Check in with your practitioner before you open your medicine cabinet, looking for relief. Antacids like Tums and Rolaids are considered safe to take during pregnancy, and some practitioners may okay gas relievers, but ask first. Your practitioner may also okay certain antidiarrheal medications, but probably only after your first trimester is safely behind you. And sick tummies, take heart. Most stomach bugs clear up by themselves within a day or two.
Staying well when you're expecting. In pregnancy, when you need to stay well for two, the proverbial ounce of prevention is worth far more than a pound of cure. The following suggestions will increase your chances of staying well when you're expecting and when you're not. Keep your resistance up. Eat the best diet possible. Get enough sleep and exercise, and don't run yourself down by running yourself ragged. Reducing stress in your life as much as you can also helps keep your immune system in tip-top shape. Avoid sick people like the plague. As best as you can, try to stay away from anyone who has a cold, flu, stomach virus, or anything else noticeably contagious. Keep your distance from coughers on the bus, avoid hugging a friend who's complaining of a sore throat, and evade the handshake of a colleague with a runny nose. Handshakes spread germs, not just greetings. Also, avoid crowded or cramped indoor spaces when you can. Wash your hands. Hands are the major spreader of infections, so wash them often and thoroughly with soap and warm water. About 20 seconds does the trick, particularly after exposure to someone you know is sick and after spending time in public places or riding on public transit. Hand washing is especially important before eating. Keep a hand sanitizer or hand sanitizing wipes in your glove compartment, in your desk drawer, and in your handbag or briefcase so you can wash up when there's no sink in sight. Don't share the germs. At home, try to limit germ-spreading contact with sick kids or a sick spouse as much as possible, avoiding finishing up their sandwich scraps and drinking from their cups. And while every sick child needs a dose of kiss and hug therapy from mom now and then, be sure to wash your hands and face or wipe them down with hand sanitizer after those comforting cuddles. Wash up with soap and water or wipe down with hand sanitizers too after touching germy sheets, towels, and used tissues, especially before touching your own eyes, nose, and mouth. See that little patients wash their hands frequently also, and try to get them to cough and sneeze into their elbows instead of their hands. A good tip for adults, too. Use disinfectant spray or wipes on phones, tablets, keyboards, remotes, and other surfaces they handle. If your own child or a child you care for or regularly spend time with develops a rash of any kind, avoid close contact and call your doctor as soon as you can, unless you already know that you are immune to chickenpox, fifth disease, and measles. Be pet smart. Keep pets in good health, updating their immunizations as necessary, and be sure to wash your hands after handling pet food or bowls. They sometimes harbor bacteria. If you have a cat, take the precautions to avoid toxoplasmosis. Look out for ticks and mosquitoes. Avoid areas where Lyme disease or the Zika or West Nile virus are prevalent, or be sure to protect yourself adequately. To each their own. Maintain a no-sharing policy when it comes to toothbrushes and other personal items, and don't let those toothbrushes mingle bristle to bristle. Use disposable cups for rinsing in the bathroom. Eat safe. To avoid foodborne illnesses, practice safe food preparation and storage habits.
CMV. I'm a preschool teacher, and we've had an outbreak of CMV at our school. Is this something I should worry about catching during pregnancy?
Fortunately, it's not likely that you can pick up CMV from one of your students and pass it on to your baby. That's because most adults were infected with CMV during childhood. If you're among that majority, or if you've had